Hey there, opera fans. I'm Eric Teague. My pronouns are he, him, his, and I'm primarily a costume designer. You may have seen some of my work in different houses around the U.S., but, fun fact, I'm also a trans man. Ever wondered how alternative identities thrive in the opera world? As someone who makes art for his living, I wanted to explore that question the best way I knew how, by talking to some folks. On this show, I'll speak with other artists who exist under the rainbow umbrella, and talk about life, work, and what makes us shine the brightest. So now I'm wearing a new hat, as your host for Come As You Are, the podcast that goes beyond the curtain with our industry's amazing artists from the LGBTQ+ community and our allies. Think of this as a virtual coffee hour with some fascinating people whose work you've heard or seen in your favorite shows. Whether singers, directors, technicians, or designers, the thing that we share in common is that we all defy the gender expectations often associated with our industry. So grab yourself a cup and join us for a good story. Today on the program, we have with us an incredibly talented artist and craftsman. His work transcends multiple genres between opera, musical theater, and film. You will have seen his work in such productions as Jagged Little Pill, Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill, Motown and Next to Normal on Broadway, The Gilded Age, Mozart in the Jungle, Gotham, Inside Amy Schumer, among many, many others in film, and Porgy and Bess, The Flying Dutchman, Barber of Seville, Written in Stone, La Boheme, and more in the opera world. Owner of BackstageArtistry.com, Drama Desk nominated, please welcome hair, wig, and makeup designer J. Jared Janis. Welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. I'm so happy that we can have some time together today.
I know. It's fantastic that you even asked me. I'm very humbled and honored that you asked me. I don't think of myself as anything like you were describing, so thank you. it's very nice to be asked, and welcome to the table, so thank you.
So here at Come As You Are, we like to introduce our identities and our pronouns up top. So, for example, I'm your friendly neighborhood trans man with he, him pronouns. How about you?
I am a gay man, and my pronouns are he, him.
Yay, awesome.
Simple. No pomp and circumstance around it, sorry.
I love it. Great. Well, I want our listeners to get to know you as quickly as possible because you're awesome. Would you mind telling us a little bit about where and how you grew up?
Sure. I was born and raised in Chicago in the 70s. I'm the first person on my father's side of the family born in the United States. So My father was born in a Nazi labor camp during World War II, as was his twin brother and his sister. And my mother's family was from Chicago and for many generations. I grew up on the north side of Chicago, and we were a pretty poor family. You know, like our part of the family, my mother, my father, my sister, and I were quite poor. For quite a while, we were on welfare. Some of the other parts of the family had a little bit more money, you know, so they weren't quite in the situation we were in. But I don't necessarily think of myself as having grown up poor, because I don't think I realized we were poor in the moment, you know, at mm-hmm. the time, obviously. You know, I think that's parents hide that kind of stuff. Or, I mean, that's sort of partly their job, I suppose, to sort of shield their kids from stuff like that, right? We just grew up, you know, knowing there were X number of things we could do, you know, so, meaning, and usually that was based on what we could afford, but I don't think I realized that till I was in my 20s, right? So.
Wow. Well, that's an incredible origin story. Like, everybody's got some kind of interesting history, but when your personal history has the overtones of such epic global events on top of it, like that's some generational stuff to work with, you know? So how did you find art as your passion?
Well, that's really an interesting place there, because I never, I mentioned that we were poor, right? So we didn't have art. I know that sounds strange, you know, because art is everywhere, but not, Not if you're poor, actually. It's just not. It's not part of your life. You know, what we could afford were the things that were free through the school or through the local park districts. And Chicago has a ton of park districts. So, you know, we were able to, like, I played baseball growing up. I used to swim. I was on the swim team growing up at my local park district, which was great. Those were my only two sports that I played. We didn't have the only art that I would say I ever heard of was television because, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. because that's what we had. We had a television. And we actually had, even though we were poor, we had two televisions. We had a little black and white in the kids' bedroom and a color in the adults' living room, so to say. That was my only exposure to art, actually. In fact, when I went to college, I actually majored in mathematics, and I became a mathematician first. So, I didn't actually discover. This is such a weird way to put it. Discover art. How does one discover art? Right, it's always there, but it was my personal introduction to art. Right, it didn't really happen until the very end of my time at the University of Chicago, when a friend of mine, I was complaining to a friend of mine that I had nothing to do for the last month. And she said, well, why don't you come help out at the theater? And I said, okay, sure. So I showed up the next day and she said, we need help in the hair and makeup department. And I said, okay, whatever you say. And I walked in. And the best part about this is that the guy who was designing the hair and makeup for the show today is a physicist. So a physicist and a mathematician walk into a hair room. You know what I mean? That's the beginning of a bad joke, right?
I love it.
Yeah. In fact, I just got to see him recently because I was designing a show at the Jiva in Rochester, and he is a physicist in Rochester. So I was so happy I got to see him recently.
So if anybody ever says that the arts and the sciences do not live in concert, they're lying.
Because they do. Completely lying. Absolutely. And I wound up doing hair and makeup on a production of Assassins in 1994 at the University of Chicago. So, you know, it's college kids creating a very adult show, right? And thinking we had to be very creative with it and make sure that because Assassins is about people who actually existed, we were trying to get these people to look sort of similar to what the real people they were portraying looked like, which of course is absolutely unnecessary in that show, but what the heck, let's go for it. But I was so blown away by what this guy had taught me about makeup and how to age someone quickly and how to just change the shape of a face quickly and how hair could change everything. And I remember 3 weeks later at the end of that run, I called my mother who was living in Las Vegas and she was coming to my graduation one more week from that point. And I just said, oh my God, I've made a terrible mistake. Now I know what I want to do.
There it is.
You know, and up to that point, like I had never thought of myself as creative in the least bit. You know, I had art class in elementary school and high school. I was afraid of it. Like I didn't want to go to art class because I didn't quote unquote have the ability, right? I couldn't draw at the time. But you know, art drawing isn't about just talent. It's about the skill involved. There's a skill you have to learn, you know? Yeah. So I didn't learn that until later, right? Because this was, art was frivolity to the poor. Do you know what I mean? There's no time for that. So I didn't get that chance. You know, our art, when you're poor, it's not accessible. You think it isn't, yet it just isn't because someone has to make it accessible to you.
Correct.
Which is really interesting. So as I said, by the time I was 21 years old, poof, I found myself just right in the center of like this, like a whirlwind of art that was going around my face and in my mind. And you're going to laugh when I say this. The first show that I ever worked on, as I said, was Assassins, a Stephen Sondheim musical. I didn't know who Stephen Sondheim was. You know, like, oh my God.
Oh, you little baby.
You know, You know, the gay man in me today is saying, what the heck? You know, but
like anything, you know, you had to learn.
Yeah, I did. I had to learn. And, you know, I mean, thankfully, I've worked on so many Sondheim productions over the years, and I've actually worked with him on his productions that wow. It's been, I mean, I feel like I've made up for lost time, but Jesus, it was 21 years of none of it. I think up to that point, just to give you an idea, up to that point, I had seen 3 shows in my entire life. Somehow my family took me to see Annie, the tour of Annie in 1978 in Chicago. I mean, I was 6. What was I going to remember of that one?
Yeah, sure.
And then in 91, someone at school said, we're going to go see Les Mis. Do you want to go see it? I said, okay, I don't know what it is, but sure. And then they said, 92, we're going to go see Miss Saigon. I'm like, what's that? And I'm like, oh, let's go see it. So I'd seen 3 musicals, and I thought that's what all musicals were.
Sure.
That's all I thought it was. And by the time I turned 21 in 93. And so when I did my first show and I did Assassins, you can imagine how blown away I was when I saw a show that was just a smaller ensemble piece. It was not this this enormous, I say this word positively, monstrosity of a musical that yes. we're used to seeing, the mega musical, right?
So I was
blown away by by what I'm calling, I don't know if it's a chamber piece, but I call it a sort of a chamber piece. Assassin's the chamber piece. You know, and I mean, so I can't even tell you what it was like the first time I saw opera. Forget it. I was just like, wait, there's something even bigger than big musicals yeah. sometimes? How's that possible? It's like it was like the amusement. It was like the amusement park of musicals. You know, you're just, oh my god.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I too feel sometimes that I can be considered like not super educated, even though I went to college and I have a master's and all of that good stuff. I still feel like, oh, you come from the South, so you must be some kind of inherent backward something, or you know, I connect with what you were saying about feeling like you go for that first impulse of this is a good thing. Let's go with this thing.
Yep.
And it's not wrong.
Right.
Sometimes yeah, we build a little.
That's definitely true. I'd say that, you know, there are one of the greatest things about working in the theater is that, you know, an outsider can suddenly feel like they belong, you know? So yes. there are parts of me that when I get to the theater, I may feel like the outsider when I get there. But I can quickly belong, you know, and I can overcome that. That outsider is obviously, I understand that that's an imposter syndrome. But it doesn't mean it's going to go away just because I understand that, you know, you know, that awkward feeling is still going to be there. There's no, it's not going to go away. It's how I mitigate it is makes all the difference, right? You know, so I will say though, somebody once asked me if I could go back and do it all over again, would I start my career sooner? Like, would I wish to have been exposed earlier? And I think that I don't feel that in my childhood I missed out, you know, because I didn't know any better in the moment. And I feel that every experience I've had has led me to where I am right now, you know? So, and part of feeling like an outsider helps you to relate to every single actor who's going to be on that stage to ensure, and for that matter, every crew member, every other designer, every creative in the room to help ensure that nobody feels like the outsider any longer, you know, like I'm incredibly, I'm very aware of feeling othered because I feel othered. I'll happily go into how that happens, but I definitely feel othered at the theater sometimes. And I work very hard to ensure that I don't make people feel othered, you know?
Oh, say that louder for people in the back to hear, because that's
right. Exactly.
That's one of the things that makes you such a stunning human is because there's no class structure around the people around you. Like, we're all merit driven people. Like, you're here because you've done a good job and you're here. and let's all be good to each other. You know, it's a lovely thing to encounter out in the wild.
Right. No, absolutely. You know, it is really interesting the way that othering, I know that's such a strange verb, but othering can happen, right? There's the big things, the big ways of othering, like excluding people from the table. Those are such very obvious ways, right? And so I'd like to think that in the theater, we all consider those things inherently, that we don't ever exclude people from the table. Mm-hmm. And yet, let me just give you a great example of how one can feel othered. And I don't think people even realize that it can make people feel othered this way. It's that, you know, there's, I'm a wig, hair, and makeup designer. And I'm always going to be working closely with a costume designer, right? And in many respects, and I also fully understand and respect that the costume designer is responsible for the look of a character from head to toe, right? We are all on the same page there. And in that sense, I will call myself a sub-designer because I am part of the costume design world, but I am a specific designer within that world. It's very similar to props designer, set designer, right? Or projection designer, set designer. I'm calling them sub-designers, but we're all still designers in our own right.
Yeah.
And yet when a stage management report comes out and you'll see scenic, props, lighting, sound, costumes, that's it. And I'm just like, are my notes under costumes? And if there's a lot of costume notes, am I supposed to look within that costume realm to figure out which notes are for me? You know, it's a very small gesture to place that one additional box on that page for the makeup, hair, and wig designer. And yet some PSMs don't do it. And I just feel like that's a way to make someone feel othered. You know, I still get that same title, that designer title, and I still get that same credit, and I still am responsible for creation of a very expensive, monetarily expensive, and personally expensive to one's soul, part of the show. And yet it's so easy to just forget that, you know, this is something so small that could really make me feel like I'm at the table. You know, so I do think there are lots of things that we do accidentally that other people, and I think just being aware of that is probably one of the most important things every single person can do to overcome many of the inequities that exist in the world. Just being aware of how everyone can feel othered, and what you can do to prevent that. You know, so, wow, I just went on a very long,
this is
very long tangent.
This is exactly why I wanted you to be on the show, was because your department is so important to the overall picture. Yes, we work together, but I feel that I have a great respect for hair and makeup designers and technicians, because my stuff only looks so good. And then you get the full picture once they get out of the hair and makeup chair, you know, like once the hair is set, once the look is right. I mean, that's how we make fully immersive characters.
Yes.
And our departments work together with performers in very intimate ways so that they feel confident and prepared enough out on stage to bear their soul in the piece. Right. Whatever it is, if it's comedy or if it's tragedy, it's still such a great outpouring of energy that if you don't feel right going out there, it's a tough evening for everyone. So
absolutely,
I desperately wanted you to be on the show, and I'm glad that we can make that happen because of these things that you were bringing up. So you illuminate in your department, very specifically, all the deeply human subtleties of a character. Like, how would they dress their hair? How would they take care of their skin? Or have they gone through some horrible circumstance where they're abused and have wounds or things like that. How do you, as a designer, start thinking about those things independently? Like, I know we work together, but when you read a character description, how do the gears start turning for you?
So how does page to stage happen? What you're asking, right?
Yeah.
You know, usually the first thing I like to do is I like to read a script before I ever chat with the costume designer very much, because I just want to form an idea of what I'm reading that's uninformed by anybody else first. I also am someone who, if this is a show, if I'm working on a show that's a revival or a continuation of some other show, I try my best never to look back at the original piece first. I don't want to be influenced by something else. I want to see that doesn't mean I'm trying to change a character that's already established, but I am saying that it's important for me to see what my mind comes up with first when reading that script, unhindered by anything that's happened in the past. So I like to read the script first, and I take so many, I read it on my iPad, and I take notes right on my iPad. And so my scripts are such a mess because it's all this, and I'm, as I get older, I'm getting blinder. So my writing is so much bigger now. And so I have this red light writing all over my scripts. It's really kind of funny. and then I have to mark each page that, like, okay, this is a page that I have to look at and talk to the costume designer about, you know. So what I'm looking for are, you know, the basic that you would think I'm looking for, right? I'm looking for, how old is the person? Where does the person come from? What's their background? Are they wealthy? Are they educated? Are they poor? Are they uneducated? You know, what are they? Does this character care about their looks? Does this character not care about those looks? Does this character pretend not to care about their looks? Because that's something as well. And that's a different look from not caring about what you look like, you know? Is this person healthy, sickly? You know, I'm looking for all the basics, you know, the things that make sense. I'm also looking for locations. Where are they living? Are they outside in the sun all the time? Are they kept indoors, sheltered from all light, you know? And then, you know, once I just get those things, then I'm also looking for the technical aspects within the script. Like, all right, this person is going from character A to character B, and it looks like I've got a half a page of script going.
Mm-hmm.
Darn, how are we going to do this? And then they got to go back to character A in two lines. Dang, how are we going to do this? You know, so that's when I start thinking, sometimes there's parts of me that think, well, gosh, I hope the costume designer has some good hats involved here, because that's going to but seriously, you know, I just start, once I've thought through the characters, then I start thinking through the technical side of it to ask, okay, what can we actually accomplish? Even though I have no idea what the costume designer wants yet, what are things that are, what are actionable plans that we can start putting into place right this second before I even talk to the costume designer? And then once that happens, you know, I usually start to try to do my own research first on these characters. You know, I'm looking at time periods and whatever. You know, obviously I have bookshelves and bookshelves of amazing research material, just like all of us. You know, I'm not someone who, I don't like to rely on Google image search for all my things. Although that's not to say that Google image search gives you nothing, because it certainly can give you something, you know, but man, I've got some great source material sitting in my own home, that I love to look at. But once that's all done, you know, obviously then the next step is working closely with amazing, brilliant artists like yourself.
So how do you, as an artist and a technician, go about learning to make everybody look their best?
So, I mean, part of it is that, you know, you have to be aware of what's real, right? And what's real today versus what's real before, meaning in the past. So aside from just walking around New York City, of course, you know, and aside from going to all those research books that I have, and aside from taking various seminars on just to understand different types of hair and different techniques and how to work with all textures of hair, you know, I think a lot of it is just sitting at my studio with the types of hair and trying it. Actually working with it and getting the feel into my fingers so I understand how this works. You know, it's funny. We one of the most important things to remember about hair and makeup design is that if I've done it right, you don't really notice it that much, right? In fact, you don't really notice it at all. I mean, unless we're talking about a fantasy show, which is a different story.
Sure.
Let's assume we're not talking about fantasy. Then you don't really notice my work. Like, you know, the biggest compliment I could ever get is, wait, that's a wig? You know, that's the absolute best compliment, you know? And the only way to do that is to understand your hair textures and to understand your hair colors and the way hair moves and to understand everything about hair. You know, and so that just requires, like I had mentioned earlier about how drawing is not just a talent, it's also a skill. Well, this is the skill part of it, right? You really have to understand the science behind the hair. You have to understand what, you know, physics exists for a reason, you know, anatomy exists for a reason, right? Like, these things exist. And so there's no denying they exist. And so you have to understand those portions of it before you can really express your talent for this. So I work with the hair. Aside from stalking people for photos. And as I said, I do also believe in working with other, collaborating with other people. I'm not only have I been a teacher for many years as well. I did open a wig making school in the past, and I've taught many people to build wigs, but I've also been a student for a long time. You know, during the pandemic, I decided, I've always been a hairdresser, but I've never been an actual barber. So I decided to go to barber school during the pandemic because why should I stop learning? You know, just because I'm the teacher doesn't mean I shouldn't stop learning, you know? So.
Oh, I love that. So you have like every skill in your bag of tricks. That's awesome.
I'm hoping I have the talent to go with the skills, but I definitely have gained the skills for sure.
You've had such a strong career for quite a long time. Obviously, you love the work. Have there been any moments where you have felt especially seen as a out gay man doing the damn thing? Like, have there ever been really good moments where you felt elevated and seen and supported by your colleagues? And conversely, have there been moments where you really didn't feel that way?
You know, what's funny is that it doesn't feel like my being gay plays into this equation that often for me. And that's, there may be many reasons for that, you know. I have to say that I have felt in the past, in certain moments, that I was not gay enough. What does that mean? Let me clarify what that means. Sometimes I felt that I wasn't fabulous enough. This is part of that othering I was talking about. Like, I'm not fabulous, and I'm putting air quotes around fabulous enough. Or that I don't want, there's a political game that sometimes I don't necessarily want to participate in. And so in that sense, I feel like that's all part of a game. That's all part of, it's sort of the darker part of our world, I suppose. That's not to make this podcast dark in any way, because I don't want to do that. Sure. But I don't think that being gay has really played as much of a factor in my work as perhaps it could have. Does that answer any part of that question at all?
It does, and I connect with that a lot because I wasn't very open about being trans until quite recently, because I wanted my work to stand for itself over any kind of ideas that anyone might have about my sexual identity or any of that sort of thing. So I also understand the feeling of not feeling like you're enough of something that someone else is looking for. So it's a respectable place to be to sort of explore.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I remember when you posted on Facebook, sort of your confessional is not the right word for it, but you professed on Facebook that you are a trans man. And I just remember thinking, all right, cool. And let's keep making art, people. I was just like, cool. You know, I've always thought like, when I meet people, when I meet actors or anyone at the stage, at the theater, and we're like, you know, there's that meet and greet, and we all stand around in a circle and everyone says their name and their part in the show, whatever they're doing for it. And then their pronouns. I try my best to remember what everyone says, although the older I get, my memory's just whoop, going. But I try my best to remember what everyone says, mostly because, as I said, I don't want anyone to feel othered. And I've always thought, like for me personally, someone making a big deal out of me being gay is actually othering in and of itself. You know, I'm like, I don't think my being gay affects you at all. Listen, I'm also someone who will be out there, you know, singing for gay rights. I sang with the Gay Men's New York City Gay Men's Chorus for 15 years. It's been 9 years since I've been a part of them, but you know, I still support them monetarily when I can, of course. You know, I'm still out there marching during Gay Pride and all these other things, and I'm donating to causes, I think, like a lot of us do. And I'm someone who does want to fight for LGBTQ rights. But I don't think it impacts my daily interaction with anybody. You know, my being gay doesn't impact that interaction at all. And it also doesn't impact as much my design work. I'm just a guy who likes to design wigs, hair, and makeup, and loves to collaborate with other people, and likes each person to feel like they're part, like they belong at that table. And so that's why I said when you put that on Facebook, I was like, cool. And now let's make some art now. Come on, let's go do some more art, because that's what it is. That's what we do. What we are is like what you and I are artists. Let's keep making art. Let's change the world through art. Let's do it.
Absolutely, the artist identity is above all.
But at the same time, I will always acknowledge everyone's identity. You know, and I think that is important. But it is, we're artists first, man. That's, you know, I look at you and you're one of my favorite artists. I love looking at your stuff. Oh, I love looking at your work. And
well, same.
So,
absolutely the same. Well, I asked that question because I am always interested to feel out everybody else's experiences in their careers, because so often LGBTQ identities have been used as a tool to other people. So I'm so happy that you have had the ability to show up for work, do the work, and be yourself. That's all that anybody wants. And I deeply appreciate you affording me the very same. So I think that's an incredible note for us to wrap up here today with. And I want to thank you again for being on the show and sharing your insight and your experience. So you're awesome. Thanks, buddy.
No, you're awesome. And thank you very much for having me on here. If I just want to wrap up with one thing, I just want to make sure everyone knows, remember the same thing I keep saying, everybody belongs at that table, and it's our job, it's everyone's job to make sure everyone feels like they belong at that table. The little things we do make a huge difference. So keep bringing people to the table.
Thank you so much for being with us today on the show. It's been great to talk after so long. I'm so happy for all of your successes and all my best for the great things to come.
And right back at you, my friend. Thank you so much.
Yeah. If our dear listeners would like to keep up with J. Jared Janis, you're going to need to book it 12 weeks in advance and chase him from set to set. But you can be sure to check out his work at his website, backstageartistry.com. You can also see pictures from some of our work together at my site, ericteaguedesign.com, and Opergeist on Etsy and Instagram. A huge thanks goes out to the team at the Atlanta Opera for making this podcast possible. And if you have enjoyed our show today, please don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and like and subscribe everywhere else fine podcasts are downloaded. And as always, y'all means all. So come as you are, and your spotlight is waiting. Bye, y'all.